the struggle makes you, that determination. If it's handed to you, you're not going to appreciate it. You're not going to work hard or strive for it. So you got to go through that. And I want that to be instilled in to the generations that come after me and my family.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurship. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I get to speak with the most innovative ideators in culture and try to figure out how they make their creative decisions. Now, I grew up in the boom-bap era of hip-hop, where each producer's work was instantly recognizable. From Dr. Dre to DJ Premier to Q-Tip to Easy Mo B, as soon as I caught the bounce and I heard that first snare, I knew who was behind the beat. Of course, as the commercial stakes increased, technology progressed, rhythm became quantized, and everybody got access to the same sounds, it became increasingly challenging to identify each musician's trademark, hence tags. Still, regardless of the shared tools, today's true innovators behind the boards managed to capture a feel and a sound that is wholly unique and absolutely signature. Which is why I'm so excited to host producer Tay Keith on this week's episode. Dude's hats just bounce and his snares always snap, every single time. From Look Alive by Blockboy JB, to Sicko Mode by Travis Scott, to Nonstop by Drake, to his super-inspired reworking of Maze's Before I Let Go by Beyoncé, the 26-year-old Tay is easily one of my favorite producers of the last decade. But honestly, those credentials only scratch the surface of what makes Tay so special and our conversation so compelling. From his humble beginnings as a teenage beatmaker, working Google AdSense and the YouTube algorithm for three-figure checks, to becoming a college DJ with local placements and a few grand in his pocket, to churning out the global hits I just mentioned the same year that he received his degree, Tay's confluence of ambition and strategy is a blueprint begging to be studied. However, what's even more inspirational and frankly impressive is the personal adversity he's overcome. A mother diagnosed first with schizophrenia and then terminal cancer, all while achieving these professional peaks. I honestly can't imagine how he held it all together, let alone produce that body of work. But to get to the heart of how Tay has achieved what he's achieved and how he's managed the stress that he's managed, I first wanted to understand how watching his parents work influenced his career and his approach to life. The Idea Generation Podcast is brought to you by Tres Generaciones Tequila.
How did your parents' professional life inform your career ambitions?
My parents always had, I guess, their own type of job. When I was born, like, my daddy was in and out of prison for drug-related offenses and things like that. So he always was a hustler. He always had his own motion going on. I think, like, by the time I got, like, 7, 8, he just wanted to just focus more on being his children's life. So he was a locksmith, like, change locks all the time, and people get locked at their cars. It's a hustle. I just remember getting picked up on the weekends, and I'd be out to, like, 9, 10 o'clock with him from him doing his locksmith calls.
So just watching him work?
Yeah, watching him work, going to sleep in the car, waking up, we still there. And my mama did her. She was a secretary, too, at the school for a couple of years, but she did that on the side, but her main hustle was doing her. So I always seen my parents make their own money. They always their own boss.
So they were entrepreneurs in their own?
In their own. They both had trades. They didn't go to college, but they had trades. My mom had trade in cosmetology, and my daddy had a trade in locksmith.
Was there anyone around you that was in more creative fields?
My stepfather, his brother, was a DJ. He was a DJ growing up, so we always went to the skate ring. So that was for sure an influence on me also. He was DJing all the time. His name was Jared. Got to start watching him and going home, downloading DJ software on the computers, playing with that.
Was music important in the household?
Yeah, it was important. My folks always had the newest bootleg CDs, the newest music when it came out. And then, like, sometimes they bought the real CDs, too.
What were they listening to?
All the Southern artists. There was Memphis artists, Tennessee, Atlanta artists, all of the big Southern music at the time, like.
Mostly hip-hop?
Yeah, mostly, majority hip-hop. My stepfather, he listened to a lot of 70s and 80s music and shit like that.
R&B and...
Yeah, R&B. It's on top of the rap, trap music. I was heavily influenced by it. That's how I got, I guess, into sampling.
I know at around 14, you had an HP computer at the house and started messing around making beats. What was the inspiration that made you download that software or really start putting stuff together yourself?
I had an iPod Nano.
Mm-hmm.
I had that, and I had some headphones and just fell in love with music. I was at the age where it was beyond CDs. It was, you download music. So I was downloading music off of the fuck he came from at the time. But to be able to have your own ideal of what you like music, I was the beginning generation of that, to, as a child, to download and listen to what I wanted to listen to. Just having the access to music made me love it more. So I would say that kind of me listening to a lot of upcoming artists, the newest music from the biggest artists to just whatever, it just influenced me to make it myself.
How did you figure out, like, how to start making beats?
It just happened. I was on SoundClick, going to SoundClick block, trying to find beats to rap on.
What was SoundClick?
It's a website with like all of the big producers of the internet when the internet wave first started for. So it was like a producer named Superstar O, like Cash Money AP. He actually a big producer now, Cash Money AP. Vibe Beats. Johnny Giuliato, that's a notable person too. So listening to their beats, me downloading them, trying to freestyle on them and shit. It went from recording on them, just playing, to me like being, maybe I need to start my own SoundClick page.
What was your process of figuring all of that stuff out and then figuring out how to then make it your own?
It was kind of like a no-brainer for me to start making music. It just was, I guess, like the good ear for music to help me. But finding my sound, like, was, I feel like, the hardest part that a lot of producers might struggle with, just finding that niche of, like, I wanted to be known as a big Memphis producer. So I took from what I learned and listened to as a Memphis child growing up, my, like, culture, and making my own niche with it, my own.
So was that something that you thought about in your head? Like, all right, I have these tools. I need to find my own voice. Like, what's my sound going to be? Take me through that process.
People would think it was the tag that got people to realize who I was. But before I had the tag, it was my beats, the sound of my beats that had that consistency and my sound that people caught on to, you know. And even when I was making music with Block Boy and Key Glock in high school, people knew my sound. They knew my beats because I had the signature sounds or the knock or the bounce to it. Yeah. And I had tags too. It just wasn't a notable tag then. But of course, when I got into the right hands and started working with the right people, the tag added to that, the value, of course. I would never take away from that, but a lot of people would think it was just because of the tag, but I know for a fact in Memphis, when I was creating that sound, it stood out so much that everybody wanted it, all the local artists wanted it.
What was the step that allowed you to take?
I bought my first laptop from a pawn shop. It was like an E-Machines. It's kind of like a cheap $40 laptop or something. It got the job done. I had that laptop all the way into like 12th grade. Was I bought it, maybe 10th grade summer going, or 10th grade. And then it lasted me all the way until I was able to make more money. 12th grade, I was able to have a name for myself with music, make beats, sell them, make money on YouTube. I have enough money to at least give me the new kicks, Air Force Ones, keep a little drip on. So that, I guess, that laptop really was the start of, because it was my own. I bought it with my hard-earned money off of putting beats on YouTube.
I know your mother got you a keyboard right around the same time, but in a somewhat crazy turn of events, you got a sign that was not meant to be. Can you explain?
By this time, I had moved with my daddy, and my mama had given me a keyboard for Christmas or my birthday. And long story short, something happened. Some shit just happened, and it was a shootout. The house, my keyboard got hit. Went through my brother's bedroom. It was in the closet. Had my shit in my brother's closet, my clothes and shit. Then went through the window. Hit my keyboard. It was like a bullet hole in the keyboard. But at the time, my daddy was basically paying for piano classes for me to go. It was like once a month or once every 2 weeks or once. I can't remember how it was, but I know he was spending money that he didn't have, really. And I was like, I wasn't really understanding my teacher at the time in the keyboard class. I didn't really want to be there. I was trying to get home, be in the neighborhood with the guys. I guess I wasn't mentally there to learn how to play the piano. So I looked at it like, man, I'm going to still get it some way, find a way to make hits, even without it.
Well, first of all, was everybody in the house, aside from the keyboard, okay after that incident?
Yeah, nobody got hit. That was the only thing in the house that, from what I remember, there was actually hit in the house, which was crazy.
That is crazy.
Besides the window.
Jesus. Well, I'm glad that was not a more serious situation. But you took that as a sign that it was...
I took it as the sign that I got from it was, don't focus on it. Focus on getting on making it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So,
you mentioned that you were trying to rap at one point here. What caused you to pivot to just focusing on the production and moving away from trying to be an artist yourself?
Because that was the time you wasn't making money off putting music up. I had people who was making money that I knew was making money off of music, but it wasn't nothing in my reach. It was like Spinrilla, That Pilf, Live Mixtapes, all those websites where you download music. It wasn't anything you could make money off of, monetize through those websites.
People were posting mixtapes and stuff and then people download them for free. And
I realized that wasn't the way I needed to go because I needed money. So I started putting them on YouTube, selling them, the beats.
In that era, how did you monetize those beats on YouTube?
It's this thing called Google AdSense, where basically you will put some on YouTube and go through the process of trying to monetize it, take a couple hours to a day or so to process, then you start making money off of it. I tried it a couple times starting off. Had to put like your tax information, all that type of stuff in there, and it was like $20 or something small.
What kind of views were these, were the beats?
I was getting hundreds of thousands of views. Hundreds of thousands of views, overall millions.
And were you doing anything to market them, or was this totally organic?
I mean, as far as market, like putting like the artist's name in those type beats.
Okay, so these are type beats. So you're making beats, thinking about what kind of artist would fit over them.
Put their pitch on there, yep. Put their name, this type beat.
And then get the search algorithm going. And
put every artist's name you could think of in the description.
And then you start getting these little checks from Google from the AdSense. And how big are the checks?
I'm like $100, $200, $150. You had to reach the threshold of $100. I never forget that. You had to make $100 just to get paid for that month. If you didn't make $100, it rolled over to the next month. When I seen that I made this amount of money, I was like, yeah, I'm finna get this check. I was like, nah, you gotta reach this threshold. So they make you wanna go a little bit harder. You know, so you getting hundreds of thousands of views this month. Overall, you probably getting, I done made a couple thousand off of it. So by this time, I'm looking at it like, my name getting bigger, I'm getting placements. I don't need to put beats out for free no more.
This, you're like 17, 18 at this
point? Yeah. So what I decided to do is create a whole nother name. I had the formula. I already knew everything to do. I made a graphic, cover, picture, put everything under a different name, email, contact, everything. Now, this was my freshman year in college. I just started putting all the beats that I was making under that name. I made a tag and everything.
What was the name?
I couldn't tell you. It's still on YouTube. it's hundreds of thousands of views on that too.
That's great. And so you just thought, I figured this part of it out, so let me just...
And it worked.
What was the first time one of your beats got to an artist and they made a song to it?
It probably was my homeboy, Baby OG, in high school. At the time, I was making beats, trying to figure out what's the best way to get them out there besides putting them on YouTube. This guy I just met, so happened from high school, that we had gym class or something. We just locked in, and he had introduced me to a couple other artists in Memphis, and he rapped on some of my beats, and it just went from there. And at the time, what was crazy is he was the first artist who got my beat on the radio. It was a competition they was doing on K97 or Hot 107.1 in Memphis. And at the time, I was just going through a lot with my mom and the family. It was just a hard time for us, struggling. And I was sleeping on the floor at the time. I didn't have no TV, but I had a radio. And I remember listening to it, and it just had me, you know, it was just a crazy moment for me. Like, I couldn't believe the shit that I'm going through in life. I was able to hear my beat on the radio. It was a precious moment for me. Like, it was crazy. I was like 10th grade, and just hearing that was just such a surreal moment. You know, it just take me back to just like the chills I got from hearing it now. Just like the thought of it.
So from there, how did you start networking and getting your beats out and working with other local artists?
Relationships. You have one relationship with, just say like Baby OG, and then having a relationship with him helped me get relationships with other artists. And it just grew from that point on. And just understanding the value of relationships. I learned that during those times. So I knew to build with these people, understand the importance of us building together, rather one of us make it, whether this one make it or not, whoever, just understand that we still had that same understanding with each other. And it just eventually just ping-pong down the line into the right situation, because at the time where I was doing stuff with Block Boy, I had a lot of other stuff going on with people I built relationships with outside of him, like Moneybagg Yo. We started working in 2015, and just us being able to make hits together. Right. Then like me and Key Glock, when I started with Baby OG, I started with Key Glock too. And just us having that relationship with each other, ping-ponging off each other, built into us having hits. And same thing with Black Youngster. One of the people I feel like I owe a lot of loyalty to, because at the time he was pretty much had his foot in the door in the music industry just off of his relationship. Me working with him to work with other people.
I understand he also gave you some very consequential advice in those early days. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
One of the things that stuck with me, first off, he always asked me what I wanted to be or who do I see myself becoming as far as producer-wise or whatever I see myself. And I always told him Metro Boomin. And he always told me he had advice to help me get to that level more than the money or the whatever the music could bring. So he always talked to me and put me on game like a little brother. So one of the things that really stuck with me that he told me that would help me was if I didn't like somebody, tell them personally I didn't like them.
This is an artist that you're working with, he's talking about?
No, he was just saying in general. Like, he was just saying if you don't fuck with somebody, you tell them you don't fuck with them. Maybe y'all can resolve, and maybe not. Maybe it's fuck each other, you know what I'm saying? Maybe just y'all just stand up there. But if you not man enough to tell them that, then you shouldn't tell nobody else because you don't know what you sabotage and telling somebody else. I could tell somebody I don't like him, and he might be best friends with that person or have some type of relation or some type of loyalty with that person through another source. Now, I told him I don't like him, and the whole time I'm shooting myself in the foot with the person. So that can go so far that people don't even understand it because they say it or they tell people. If they knew how far that can go, they wouldn't understand not to voice that, or if they really had an issue to a point where it really bothered them, then they would address it. But if somebody did some, just say for example, somebody did some flawed or fugazi, I'm just like, all right, I can't rock with them. Just leave it at that. I might not even feel the need to address it. It is what it is. I took my loss, you know what I'm saying? I'm not gonna go around judging this, telling people this what type of character this person is because of that reason. You feel me? I just know I can't deal with you no more. You might be fair to them or handle business well with them, but to me, I feel like you were flawed, so I ain't gotta address it. Unless it's something that really jeopardized me or my character or who I am as a person, then I feel like I gotta address it. But that's something he taught me that I just really stand with and believe in and see how much it has helped me in my career.
When you look at who you were coming up with in that moment and where all of you guys are now, with Moneybagg Yo, Key Glock, you know, I mean, in 2015, you know, all of you guys were extremely underground.
Yeah,
and now these are some of the biggest streaming artists. You're obviously one of the biggest hit makers in the industry. Maintaining mm-hmm. those relationships and that energy is incredibly important, and being forthright with people because, you know, it all comes back around.
Full circle. So, I mean, for Memphis, it took Memphis, at least 20 years to get to this moment in hip-hop. From the first biggest Memphis artist in the 90s or whatever, it was just like position people was put in, it just didn't work out. So me being able to be a part of the reason why Memphis is getting the shine now with these artists and them being the reason they putting on their artists and signing people from Memphis just like I am. And us coming together, uniting, and having that mutual respect for each other through the differences or whatever, it's just, you know, it's a beautiful thing for Memphis.
By the time you graduate high school, mm-hmm. you got a bunch of placements, you're working the local scene, you're finding your own voice and your sound. Why go to college?
I had a couple reasons. For one, I got to a point where I feel like I was getting too consumed around my environment. Like I said, I always been a leader. I never been a follower. So it got to a point where I was getting too consumed with what was going around me, just like the struggle, peers, and the influence of Memphis. It just was me. I always knew I was going to be a boss or a CEO. So I had the opportunity. I had a good ACT score. Matter of fact, when I took it, I didn't know I was going to take it that day. I just walked into class. It was like, well, you got to go to your home room. Because, you know, you usually go to the first period. I walked in. I was like, damn, where my class? I was late. I was like, well, you got to go take the ACT today. But anyway, I made a 19 on there. So I knew I was able to get accepted to pretty much any college in Tennessee. So I had something to look forward to. Unlike a lot of people who I was around and kicking it with, they didn't have the aspiration or goals or drive or dreams. So I knew I had a chance to make something out of myself and become successful. So that was my mindset. I had to get away from the negative shit, getting put out and shit senior year. And my mama ended up getting Section 8. I was staying with my daddy, but she ended up getting Section 8. So I had to stay in college. When I went to college, I had to stay in school so she can keep getting it. So by the time I got to school, I got in the field for it, got comfortable, I knew it was something that I can maintain and deal with. So that kind of kept me going.
Tres Generaciones is the tequila for dreamers and doers who persevere against all odds. It's made from 100% blue agave, distilled with water sourced from an ancient aquifer beneath the tequila volcano, and triple distilled for unrivaled smoothness. The brand's been around since 1973, and their demonstrated track record of success is the reason why Tres is eager to champion creatives with perseverance everywhere. So whether you're already at the top of your game or just setting out on your creative voyage, let Tres be your running partner on this journey. As you can hear, Tay Keith is a pretty low-key individual, but his even-keeled demeanor doesn't obscure the ambition and intelligence that have driven his career. The challenges he faced early in life, from uncertain living conditions to having an early musical instrument destroyed, would be enough to derail the dreams of many people. But there's a quiet determination that's allowed him to overcome these obstacles and achieve at the highest levels. Tay Keith's story is one of canny and smarts, too. He's from a generation that was introduced to the music via the internet, and his approach to using the nuances of search algorithm and other tricks of the World Wide Web are absolutely fascinating. Aspiring A&Rs will want to hear Tay's hack for discovering new artists later in the show. But as much as anything, Tay Keith's ability to build relationships with people has been the through line of his career. And make no mistake, the ability to read people and approach them on their level is one of the highest forms of intelligence that there is. Before he worked with Drake or Travis Scott or Beyonce, Tay was building the foundation for a long and fruitful career by building with a variety of creative associates. It's what got him in the game, and it's what's kept him relevant. Relationship building is the kind of intelligence you don't need to go to college to acquire. But given the fact that Tay did decide to go to school, despite the fact that he probably didn't need to, I was curious to understand what he gained from that experience.
When you reflect back on that experience in college, what were the most important things, both academically and socially, that you took from that?
I really put more into the social life because at the time I was making money out DJing in the parties. That was how I was paying rent. I had three jobs. I quit all of them. And
what were your three jobs?
Hippie Sports, Bargain Hunt, and I worked in my apartments picking up trash, like a maintenance tech assistant or some shit.
But you doing all this and making beats?
Not the three jobs was the span of a year.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? I had two jobs that summer, then I got another job the next summer. Well, I worked all my jobs with my homeboys. I was a maintenance assistant with one of my homeboys, and I worked at Bargain Hunt with two of my friends, and one of my guys I went to high school with.
So then you start DJing?
Yeah, I started. I had been DJing, but I wasn't making no money. So I'm like, man, let me figure out a way to take this to the next level. When I first got my equipment, my turntables, my homeboy DJ Meech, and another homeboy I had got, like Kyler, like a big brother to me, they had invested in my turntables. Helped me buy my first turntables. And I was DJing like house parties then, getting my name up to a point where people would even come to my parties if I was DJ parties. So when I started doing that, I started making 150 here, weekend, 200 this weekend, decent money, at least enough to pay the bills. That basically, my social life and my academic life were two different things, but I ended up bridging them together because me being who I was at the parties and DJing and stuff, a lot of people helped me out when it came to school too. I had friends, I had associates. Hey, you can help me with the quiz or the homework or what we had to do this day. I couldn't make it to class. I always had people who I socialized with who just from doing what I was doing on campus to classroom helped me. That was before I was who I was. I was just known like in the city and popular on campus.
That networking and that social part is like, yeah, it's one of the most important parts of being in school in my opinion. What you learn in the classroom is cool, but just figuring out how to relate with other people your age, and it's a bigger network. I'm curious, when you're DJing these parties, you get to see how people are reacting to records in real time. Mm-hmm. Did that influence your thinking about the music that you were making?
That's a good question. Yeah, BPM-wise, for sure. That's when I learned the importance of the speed of the beat, because majority of the songs that were like the club songs, and it's different because I'm just speaking for, like, I guess, like, where I was in Middle Tennessee, so I'm assuming Memphis, Chattanooga, Mississippi areas, Arkansas, Alabama, that southern little area right there, this was what they was listening to. So when I was DJing the parties, I was realizing it was people dancing to the songs from this mid-range BPM, like 65 to 70 BPM. And I was like, you know what? I need to start making beats in this same range. First, I was making slower beats. But it was still hits, though, like local hits. But I was like, this kind of like that range of tempo that I need to stick with.
So during your time in school, you engineered what will become your breakout year. Mm-hmm. When you think back about that, 2015, you're still very, very local. By 2016, you're starting to get placements that are on streaming apps and with artists that are signed to real labels. And by 2018, you have number one song in the country. When you think about that path, what were the key moments that changed everything along that?
I think when I first got my BMI check, there was some real money. It was like,
You hadn't done a publishing deal yet?
Yeah, it was just BMI.
You're just getting them. Okay.
Yeah, from songs I produce. Like, it was a decent amount of money. I'm like, what the fuck I'm doing wrong if I getting this money.
When you say a decent amount of money, what's the ballpark?
Couple thousand.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm like, damn, if I could have been getting this money. I'm like, shit, what I'm doing wrong if I'm focusing on, I guess, like, DJing too much or whatnot, DJing money, which was cool, it was living, but I'm like, I need to go more all in and making music. So he put me in a mindset of going a little bit harder with making music and focusing less on DJing. So it got to a point where I was DJing, but I was only DJing the records I was producing, like my own show or segment, like, of a set of me performing, basically, songs I was producing.
Okay. And then how were you getting placements? This is before the pub deal. Who is shopping the beats, or is this happening off of YouTube
services? By that time, like I told you, I had switched over to a new name on YouTube, so the placements was based off relationships, and my manager sent them out to artists, too.
And you met your manager in college?
Yeah. Yeah, so.
How did that happen?
We was throwing the parties, and I wanted him to throw parties with us, so I brought him along, and he started throwing graphics and photography and videos and all that, and I just seen him being way more useful than just that. So he started trying to help me with my career by, I guess, like, selling the ideal of me being bigger than who I was at the time. And it started working. It was helping me. We was making a lot of relationships, not just with artists, but with A&Rs, who at the time would be some of the, like, now would be some of the biggest A&Rs in the game, but then was just starting, or other producers. We was just hungry and trying to figure out a way to make it work. So it just added fuel to the fire, what I was doing already, and the relationship that I had to him helping me when it came to the industry. You know, the I guess, like, the relationship side of, outside of the artist and producer.
I was going to say, neither of you really had any experience within the industry or within music like that, obviously outside of making it.
Make our story so unique because we didn't go to school for this. We didn't do internships for this. We didn't do training for this. We just did it and it's working. And now people admire us to the point where they're willing to put their career in our hands. And people want him to manage and consult with an A&R, and they want me to executive produce and all this. I don't know music. I don't know how to read music. I don't know notes. He don't know how to, I guess, professionally manage or A&R. It's just something we just started doing and it just worked. So I guess you can call it working and, you know, just building relationships and just going along with it. But we didn't do this professionally from the jump. We just learned as we went.
What was it about him that made you say, this is the guy I want to figure it out with?
It's just like a couple moments where we just felt like it was working. Certain things we was doing that was like one of my first interviews, we had went to Memphis, and so a guy wanted to interview me, and we put the interview out, and it just started getting good traction. People was watching it, and we like, damn, this working. And then we did another interview with a magazine. It was my first magazine interview with Concrete. And then we was like, it might be something that we're really doing right if they want to do a whole magazine article on you. And from that point on to us actually working with bigger artists and making it, like, he making calls, reaching out to people where we working with artists that we listening to. You know what I'm saying? It's like, damn, they familiar enough with me and he make the move enough where he can get me in a room with these folks. So we just put that together like, oh, shit. Even if nothing came out of it, we still did it. Like, we was in the studio with, like, Young Nudie, Black Youngster, Young Scooter, like a lot of Atlanta artists. We knew enough to go to Atlanta and work, for sure. Lucci, a lot of these artists we were listening to. Then on top of that, we still had what we was doing in Memphis.
Back in the early 90s or mid 90s, the producers would get paid like flat fee, you know, $5,000 for the beat, or $1,000 up front, $5,000 in the mix, and then whatever their splits are later. And by the early aughts, you had the Pharrells and the Timberlands, where it's like you gotta have $80,000 or $100,000 for them to step in the room for a day rate. But in the Type B era, I know that changed. So when you're now at this place where you've got 15, 20 placements, things are starting to move. What was this financial model for how, when you go to Atlanta and it's like, all right, I'm gonna have this opportunity to get in the studio, like, how did that work?
That's a good point. So the game had went like this for producers that can collect the money. You know what I'm saying? That's when I came in the game right here. It was Spin Really, it was Live Mixtapes. You wanted your name on the credit. You know what I'm saying? You weren't doing it for no type of money whatsoever. So the songs that I was producing in that era, when they started getting registered and all this, we started having to do paperwork for it. That's when my career was projected to...
Because it goes off of those to streaming.
Yeah, so
streaming.
It wasn't even about money. It was, let me get in this room so I can get a beat place where when they do release that mixtape, it say the song title produced by me on the title. It wasn't about, like, you trying to get paid for it. So when I started getting the paperwork for the songs I was doing and all this and that, it was a surprise to me then because I'm like, damn, well... Shit, I was just doing it for credit. So I guess that molded in my mind for me not to care about the money. Never in my career.
How did you guys think about setting your rate or, you know?
That's a good question. It just started happening. When I was producing for Moneybagg and Black Youngster, when it started to come to the paperwork, it was like, well, they got a certain budget for beats. And I'm like, well, I ain't finna charge y'all, try to go overcharge y'all for what we just genuinely created. So whatever y'all got, I'm cool with it. So I started rolling with that budget, that price. And then I was charging a couple hundred for collabs. loops and how their producers want to work or whatever. Then it can start getting to, all right, you got a Drake placement now. You can't be charging $5,000 for a beat. But you can go up on your prices a little bit if you want to, you feel me? So then it was just like artists start coming and, of course, it got higher and higher, so.
So let's go back to 2018. This on December 31st, 2017, did you have any idea what the next 365 days were going to look like?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. That was one of the best Christmases of my life because Rover had just went viral right after shoot. Block Boy was on fire. We was having phone calls with some of the biggest people in the industry. I think around the time Drake had just hit us up, it was end of 2017. So the new year, I'm looking like, man, something to break through. Like, I'm able to get the new Jordans. You growing up in Memphis, this is how you want to do, cop the new J's. I got the new J's on my feet. I got a whip. You know, I got my dream car. I had bought my dream car, Camaro. It's just nostalgic. Like, the time, it was so good for me. And I just knew something bigger was coming. I just didn't know to this extent. I didn't realize it would be this big, but I'm like, man, I know I'm going to damn to make a real hit next year, like some, but, you know, when 2018 came, it's just, God just flourished me with so much.
You had the block, you had Look Alive, right into Sicko Mode.
No, it was Look Alive, then Nonstop.
Oh, then Nonstop, yes,
then
that's right.
Sicko Mode, yeah.
That's quite a run. In addition to a handful of other records.
Yeah, I had plenty of other songs during that time too. And I was able to work with, like, you know, my idols, like people who I was looking up to in the music industry. That was the greatest part of it all. You know, I had always been listening to Drake. I had always been listening to Lil Wayne. I had always been listening to, you know, shit, the list goes on, you feel me? Eminem and, you know, being able to work with him, and it just, the list goes on.
In that year, you get the opportunity to be in the studio and to work with these legends that you looked up to. What were the things you were learning, and how was it changing your thought process about your own work as you move forward?
I was just talking to my team about this, like, when you first coming up, you so desperate to make a hit. You so desperate to get in the industry. You so desperate to, you know, become successful in the music industry. Like, I had almost forgot that feeling based off of me working with the greats, like the greatest artists and stuff for so long. I had almost forgot the feeling of, damn, you make one hit, that's like hitting the lottery. You make two hits, that's like almost impossible. And to make so many more, it just, like, what I learned, you know, that I had got accustomed to was, like, you don't have to always be, I guess, opportunistic or eager to make moves to get to this point. Because when you win, you win. You know, it just take hard work and dedication to get to that point. But you can't do messed up things or bad things or flawed things or burn bridges with people to get to this point. So when I got to this point, I realized, like, I had never really been in that situation where I had to do those things. But now I'm here, I realize how much of a burden it was lift off my shoulder that I didn't have to do those things to get here. Now I can work with these people, build with these people on this higher level without having to worry about some coming to bite me in my ass or for me, you know what I'm saying, being that desperate or that eager to get into the game.
Sicko Mode has, you're one of several different producers on that record, and that's sort of become much more of a trend in the last, I don't know, let's say like 6 or 7 years, where you have Metro and Southside and D-Coop, and there's a handful of people, and you have sort of session players, loop finders, loop makers, drum programmers. When those opportunities come up, how does that actually work? Like, when you have 3 or 4 producers on a record, like, is one person kind of the architect and then pulling in other people to provide parts.
Well, artists who really work on, like, their music, they bring in producers. These are their choices. Like, a lot of people that they in-house producers or the circle small, so they stick with certain producers that they just randomly choose to rap on their beats. It just be, all right, I got this relationship with this producer. I want him to lay some keys down or whatever, make some cool melodies or whatever. You might bring this producer of yours that you got a good relationship in for the drums and whatever the case might be. You might bring this producer who you've been working with do post-production. Like, that's what a good artist nowadays, I feel like, will do. And then it's also the artists who get random beats that's sent to them, and they make hits out of that. But then this with the beat, it was sent to another producer, and it had loops on it whole time. Now that it's three people on that loop. Then you got the other producer who sent it to the artist, who got the relationship with the artist, or whatever the case might be with their artist. Now it's four people on the beat. You get what I'm saying? So it's two different ways it can go. It can go, the artist can bring it all together, but then you got a beat that the artist might like, and then they got additional producers on it, was just brought to them.
Okay, so something like Sicko Mode, Travis, probably he hears your beat, he likes it. Here's the hip boy part, figures out, works with Mike Dean on some bridges, how do I make these things work together?
All of us are like, I'm pretty sure that was just strictly in-house, because all of us are in cahoots with each other. Like, those producers who I can hit up today, it wasn't like random producers, you know what I'm saying?
Did you get to hear the final product before it came out?
Huh? Like, I can't even remember. I think it was like 2018, August. I think we had just went to Six Flags thing they had, and when we left, it had dropped, and I was like, damn, this the final product. I'm like, this shit is crazy. We brought the song back like 10 times on the way home. Like, it's crazy though, when I think about that moment, that was crazy.
Generally speaking, do you make specific beats for specific artists? And then two, do you do it kind of like by yourself and then share them with them? Or do you like to be in the room with them and working, creating, you know, sort of collaboratively?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. Sometimes the artists nowadays, like in the hip hop, you go off the vibe of them because they have a specific type of vibe that they bring with music that they want to stick with. But then there's also like artists who would be comfortable with experiencing and experiment in different sounds and stuff that you can actually have a voice or be more hands-on with.
So in 2018, you are experiencing incredible professional highs, but I know you're also going through a lot on the personal side with your mom, both with her mental health and also she was dealing with cancer at the time. How did you manage to navigate, you know, being present and dealing with your own mental health through all of that, while also still trying to keep pushing your career forward?
So at the time I was dealing with that with my mom, it was like the beginning of my career, like that hype. So my mind wasn't always where I wanted to be at, to enjoy the moment. I just always had that cloud over my head thinking about what was going on, and it was just hard to deal with. I feel like what helped me was family, of course, but also being vocal about it and talking about it and being comfortable making awareness of mental health and not just keeping it all in and letting it boil up. When it came to my mom's mental health, I think it was more of me getting control over it, like using my resources that I had, the money to be able to get lawyers and attorneys to fight for the rights over her, get the conservatorship over her where I can get her treatment and help. And that process was so long and it was so much, and it just showed me like the corruption within certain things, within what was going on. And when I finally was at a place where I was able to get her under control and stuff. That's when we found out that she had cancer. So that went from us dealing with the mental health to the physical health, stage 3 cancer. It was like, it was a year before she passed when we found out. So it was like the whole trajectory of our thinking or like how we was treating her had just shifted. It was just crazy, like that whole moment, just me dealing with that and still trying to keep a smile on my face when I'm doing interviews. And it got to a point where I had stopped interviewing, and I feel like I just had a lot of, I guess, negative thoughts. You know what I'm saying? It was affecting me. I felt like I was just in a place where I wasn't happy with myself. I wasn't happy with my appearance. I just wasn't happy with just like life at the moments. When I just had to grow from that and learn from it and accept that I couldn't control everything or have control of everything and just let God be. And it just really started helping me more to where I was comfortable enough to talk about it in interviews and tell people, like, it's okay if you're dealing with this. People are going to always look down upon people who have mental illness. They're going to think they crazy or look at them like they not human or whatnot just because of what they dealing with or have dealt with. And it's like something that I just want to bring awareness to, like, it's okay. I always encourage people and talk to them about what to do and what steps to take when you got a parent in that situation or a family member. Like, don't y'all turn y'all back on them. There's ways you can help without having to just leave them out there.
How old were you when she was diagnosed with schizophrenia?
18. I was a freshman in college, and it was over a week course where I just knew something wasn't right, and then one day, one night she woke me up, and it was just, I just knew she wasn't going to be the same ever since. And they had to take her to a mental hospital in Memphis. And it was a course of treatment for a couple of weeks, and it just was, the symptoms kept coming back. And it was just something that I had to get used to dealing with. It made me so strong, though. You don't understand, like, from the moment of me realizing that This could never be the same with my mama, like, she was never the same person, and accepting it, like, mentally, like, physically, like, in my mind and in my heart, like, accepting it, like, damn, like, this crazy. It made me so much stronger to the moments where it was the last with her. Like, I'm just accepting this over the course of 6 years, 6, 7 years before it.
I mean, that is a huge amount for a young person, an 18-year-old, to have to deal with at a very volatile time in anybody's life, you know, being a teenager like that, and to be doing it while you're building the earliest stages of, right, you know, your
but
career.
I never showed it. Nobody knew until, like, recently when I started talking about it. They didn't. Of course, like, people in Memphis knew. People had their opinions about it. I always felt like it was something hard to deal with. I always was in defense mode about it. It's just, I can't control it, though. I did what I could, and I had to do it the right way. I had to go through the court system, the law, to get the rights. I couldn't just be able to bring my mama to me, and it just didn't work like that. And people don't know how to deal with those issues when it comes to mentally ill people. But thank God I had my auntie. My auntie was a big help in the process, just through the trauma and just the moments where it was like I feel like it was something I couldn't even control or handle by myself. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, no. Again, at any age, that's a lot. But at 18, that's crazy.
Right. It's almost like you want to ask yourself, like, when your mom, if your parent was to go through this or something like this, it's like, this is almost like the person that you knew was gone already, but they right in front of you. But it's like they a whole different person, like, and it's like, damn, like, how do you deal with that, basically? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, how did you come to terms with that?
I guess the way I really came to terms was being vocal about it and actually talking to people about it and not holding it in. Like I said, like, me talking to you now, I got to a place where I feel like me expressing this, people going to see this or watch it, I'm going to be helping them. That's enough to help me to know I'm helping somebody by letting them know they not alone with dealing with this. They can make it happen. They can help their family members or loved ones. It just take time. It takes courage to look into a lot of things, to know these programs in whatever city they in. You got to call these attorneys and these lawyers to see who actually can get the job done. I'd have been in situations where I'd have paid my money to lawyers where really they just bullshitted me and had me back at square one or step one. And me and my auntie having to go to court cases and figure things out or know the next step for the next couple months while my mom's still having her problems and we having to find where she is. And you know what I'm saying?
What was it like 2018? You have this breakout year and you really elevate and become a celebrity in a real way. And all of a sudden with that comes scrutiny and everyone on the internet having an opinion about everything that you do while you're trying to deal with this privately and no one having perspective on what you're juggling. You know, how did you maintain through that?
I looked at it as God had already prepared me for this. Growing up, I had a lot of things that I went through, a lot of pain, like just a lot of things I went through, like physically, that prepared me for being so strong where I didn't let it deter me or I didn't let this get to me or, like, people who know, like, the things I dealt with growing up as a child, that it was always me, like, having the odds against me. I always had the odds against me. Like, my family know this, you know what I'm saying? My close friends know this. Like, I just always went through, like, misery growing up. And basically, when things started looking up for me in life and I was able to become successful in what I was doing, the problems that I had then, it was like they was 10 times worse. Who expects for their mom to lose her mind and it just ain't the same person or deal with something like that when you got all this success? So God had already prepared me growing up from elementary, you know what I'm saying, to I was 18 to 21 years old in my career to get to that level where I can deal with whatever he sent my way or he want me to go through to make me even stronger.
Before we started this interview, Tay and I were talking off camera and he told me a little bit about his mother's twin illnesses, both her diagnosis with schizophrenia and her fight with cancer. Just before we started rolling tape, I checked with him to see if it was something he really wanted to speak on, and he was adamant that we talk about it. It would have been easy for him to keep the conversation to the highlights of his career and to questions about the music industry that I love to nerd out on. But he's on a mission to raise awareness about mental illness and to provide an example to people who might find themselves trying to support family going through crisis. It's a tribute to his character, and I'm grateful he chose this show to open up about what he's been through and to offer his hard-earned advice. Tay's mom died a year and a half ago, in 2021, just before Tay embarked on a renaissance of sorts. With Hallmark production for Drake and 21 Savage, on tracks like Jimmy Cook's and Circo Loco, Tay Keith announced that he was back in a big way. But he continued to make street records as well, proving a knack for versatility that ensures his staying power in the game. The key to his success is no secret, but also something more easily spoken about than accomplished. Over and over, Tay Keith speaks about the importance of cultivating relationships with collaborators both old and new. It's a refreshing approach to art, not to mention a lucrative one. I wanted to hear more about Tay crafting hits in this new era, but given the challenges that he's faced throughout his life, I was also curious about how his definition for success may have changed throughout the years.
When we were talking before, I was throwing those questions at you, and I asked you if, in hindsight, success is as satisfying as you had hoped it would be. You were very quick to say no. How would you describe it if you were talking to a 16 or an 18-year-old that's trying to make it as an artist or a producer or something in entertainment? Like, what do you think is a realistic expectation?
I think the realistic expectation to be successful would be what makes you feel like you're complete. Like I said, somebody who graduated through college might feel successful. Somebody who graduated high school might feel like they're successful to them. Well, who is the judge of this being successful and this not being successful? It's what you take it as, whether you feel like it's a completion for you. So me saying that means I'm not where I want to be as far as success means I'm not completed. I think I have higher tiers to go or to accomplish before I feel like I'm successful. And who knows, I might accomplish those things and then later on I might be like, damn, I still don't feel like I'm successful. Or it's just a mindset that I have to keep going no matter what. I might be doing this until I'm dead, you know what I'm saying, trying to achieve success.
After college, and once you achieved that level and you got multiple hit records and you're the most in-demand producer out, what were the new goals after you had achieved all of that?
I don't know, because it happened so fast. The goals then was complete school and make a hit. Then everything just started happening so fast, and then I graduated college. It's two things. One is time management. I feel like when I was in school, I was very dedicated and disciplined with time. And two is my peers, where I graduated with, high school and college. Like, these folks gonna be doctors now. They lawyers graduating with all types of big degrees. And I'm like, man, these folks got doctors by their name. Like, that's what I wanted. I wanted to, because I just feel like that's just success to me. Even me being the successor of the class, like the one who was the most successful and whatever, I feel like, damn, I wanted to keep going. I wanted to just stick with school.
You're now an honorary professor.
Honorary professor, yeah. But I do want to go back. I feel like I won't be fulfilled as far as success until I give me at least a master's. I want to get my doctorate, but I want to get my master's for sure.
Do you know in what?
Nothing. I don't know. Whatever I can get it in, whatever be the easiest. I just want to say I did. I was first generation to go to college. Just from hundreds of years of my family legacy, like my grandmama, my parents, my grandmama, great-grandmama, great-great-grandmama, they fought and went through what they did for this to happen, this moment, for me to go to college and become successful and do what I feel like I got to keep going. My family didn't have, my ancestors and shit didn't even have the right to go to school. You know what I'm saying? It was like now, me being in my position, I feel like I got to at least achieve the highest I can. So I'm going to keep going.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that you've already done things that will change the trajectory of your family forever. But I appreciate that.
And I don't have kids, but I'm hard on my nephew. I want him to know, like, life might be set for you when you turn 18, but you got to work hard for this. I want you to understand the struggles that I went through to get to this point. Even with my kids or my nieces and nephews, I want them to understand that struggle makes you. That determination, if it's handed to you, you're not going to appreciate it. You're not going to work hard or strive for it. So you got to go through that, and I want that to be instilled into the generations that come after me and my family. I'm not saying I want them to go, no, I don't struggle or no shit like that, but they got to go through that.
At least to understand challenge and to overcoming adversity, whatever that adversity is. Yeah. And that, to your point, those can be challenges that you put in front of yourself, like getting a master's, right. You know?
Like, you go to school, you get your education, then I might talk about, we might consider getting you that Benz you want, or, you know what I'm saying, helping you get your first house. Like, you go do that. You got to go through that challenge.
You've talked about the importance of radio for, you know, your sort of overall success. And it's an interesting time, because I think about how you could have an artist like an NBA Youngboy, who obviously one of the biggest artists around, never had a radio hit. But then there is still that value in having the ubiquity of a record that is absolutely everywhere. Right. We live in a new paradigm of music where there's the things that permeate all of pop culture, but then there's also the ability for things to be enormous in these sort of vertical niches.
Compared to that situation with Youngboy, like, even what I was doing in Memphis, like, no label seen that coming. Not one. Only person who probably seen it coming was CMG with Gotti, because they in Memphis.
Yeah.
No other label seen it. They would have signed these artists years ago if they seen the trajectory of us, what we was doing outside of, like, streaming wise, and, well, outside of for the radio and, like, the big industry plays, but streaming wise and YouTube numbers and all of that came to what Memphis has formed now. But when I was speaking about radio being a big part, that's when it comes to publishing.
Okay.
That's what producers use to make a living, basically. When it comes to big radio songs, you get couple hundred thousand off publishing. So when it comes to me saying, like, radio is such a big part of my career, it was from a standpoint of me being a producer, a songwriter. Even the artists, they had they big percentages of the publishing too. They just see a different side of the money with the records.
So you could have a huge streaming, like an album cut on a, you know, major streaming artist, and that money is not going to be anywhere near having that one huge radio record, correct?
Correct. Because I got songs that went platinum that didn't really do good on the radio, that I made more money off songs that's not even, you know what I'm saying, platinum, even though they haven't been out that long, but they on the radio good, that has made more money than those songs made already.
Without asking, like, numbers or anything, what does the revenue pie look like in terms of percentages? There's the front half or whatever, the payment for the beat, the publishing, the mechanicals. What does that pie look like?
You know, it's crazy. To this day, I still don't really fully understand how it works, which is crazy because I actually try to learn how it works. It's just so much that goes on with it. Me, personally, I get my majority of my money from publishing.
Okay.
Between the publishing and, like, performance, and then you got the mechanicals. I haven't really seen that much off mechanicals, because producers in general, we get what? Producers starting off maybe 3%, 3 points.
Okay.
They go, like, up to 5 or 6. Then feature credit, you probably get a little bit more. It was like, you don't really just see that much on mechanicals, but as far as publishing, like, I don't think I really understood the importance of it until I got my first pub deal offer, and it was like, damn.
What year did you get your pub deal?
Did an admin deal, but 2018.
Okay, and the admin deal basically means that they just chase down the monies from BMI, et cetera, but they're not giving you an upfront cash.
They cutting the upfront cash down. Okay. It's basically the same thing. You know, you just... One is just you get more money up front. The pub, you get more money up front because it's a co-pub situation. They own your publishing with you. Then admin, you own your own publishing. What I mean, you know, publishing revert back to you after a certain amount of years anyway, for the most part, so.
Are the publishers helpful in getting you placements, getting you syncs?
Yeah. So I'm signing Warner Chappell.
Okay.
The first night I met Warner Chappell, I met with Big John and Ryan Press. After the meeting, Ryan Press took me to the studio with Wiz Khalifa, and I gave Wiz some beats. And he made a song called Real Rich. And that night, you know, I left the studio, whatever, didn't think none of the song came out, whatever. And the song went gold. Even though it was years later, it let me know I made the right choice of signing with them, because if I had no other hit, you know, besides Look Alive, I would have had this hit that I made with Big John and Ryan Press. You know what I'm saying?
Off that first night.
First night.
That's crazy.
Hell yeah, they make. I've made so many hits and relationships off of, you know, working with the whole Warner team, the Warner Chapel team. Like, I love them people. It's mutual. We all came up together. So, you know, just me being 20, 21 at the time, to me being 26 with like 30 hits later, it's like crazy.
There's a lot said, particularly on the internet, by people who are watching the industry about ownership and owning one's masters. But obviously then you see a lot of producers and artists selling their catalogs to Hypnosis and these different companies. How do you think about that side of the business?
Well, I mean, it's all about the position you're in life. Like, me personally, I would just speak from my own experience why I would sell my catalog if I was in that situation. It would be because I got a play where I put, you know, $10 million in the next 5 years, I'm going to make, you know, this certain amount of money, and it's guaranteed. Like, I won't be risking my catalog, I won't be risking my investment, you know. It's just a guaranteed play for me. And it's like, you don't really come across that much, you know. But another reason would be if I was in, like, you know, I feel like I was in some trouble with the IRS. I just needed to, you know, everybody go through that. You know, everybody then experience IRS hiccups or whatever along the way. So if I was in a situation where I just, you know, didn't want to deal with it, I just here, I sell some of my catalog, you know. Or, you know, it might be a situation where I feel like I might, we all going to have to come to that day. One day, you know, I might be in my last moments of life and be like, all right, I'm just sell my catalog and leave the money to my kids or something, you know. But them just situations how people, you know, so you won't feel, well, take it as people just selling their catalog and it's just a bad thing. It could be an advantage for them, you know, in the long run.
Totally. Yeah, I think people think that it has to be all the way one way or another. And to your point, it's nuanced and it really depends on the circumstances, because
it's a mutual thing, you know. It might be some people might sell their catalog for, you know, $10 million, $15 million, whatever, and make 150 of it, 10 times that, you know. I just ain't been in the right place to actually make that risk, you know. But of course, if it come my way, I wouldn't mind, you know, considering to negotiate the terms or whatever, to see what the most I can get out of it.
You know, watching hip-hop evolve over time, you can look at places like Long Island in the late 80s or like Queensbridge in the 94, 95, where you had Nas and Mobb Deep and all these guys, like CNN. A lot of times there will be moments of energy and then it starts to dissipate, but it feels like, particularly with Memphis, but Detroit as well, those windows are getting bigger. And what do you think is sort of the key to extending that success within a local scene?
Back in the day, before the whole Memphis scene took off, I would have said put labels in the city. You know, record labels in Memphis, like these big labels now, they don't have offices in Memphis. I would have said put them there. But now, since Memphis have their spotlight, the labels are going to Memphis. You know, they flying to Memphis. They working with artists in Memphis. It's different from, you know, like artists up north in New York and big cities and stuff like that. We didn't have that. So I would say what would, like, help that now would be just the unity and, I guess, taking full advantage of social media. So, like, that being said, the cameramen play a big part in Memphis. They have these platforms like Wicked Films. He's one of the biggest, you know, videographers and music video directors in the South now. But he started in Memphis. He used his platform to shoot Moneybagg videos and Black Youngster videos and, you know what I'm saying, Block Boy videos. And he accelerated and became bigger as he was shooting these videos. And he was charging little to nothing at the time. And I remember he stayed in South Memphis in these apartments. I had some family stay over there, and that's how I met him and stuff when I was like 15. And he was amazed that I was even going back to putting beats on YouTube. And, you know, that just kind of like was the beginning of our relationship. But him having that platform to bring that attention to Memphis, it helped unite Memphis a lot because he had a voice, a producer like me having a voice too, because songs I'm producing on his channel getting millions of views with these upcoming artists, and it just connected it all. So I feel like that's what we really needed. We needed the platforms. We didn't have that. It wasn't about the labels coming to Memphis then. It wasn't about the labels building or, you know, signing artists in Memphis, because it didn't work. It took the people from Memphis who was growing up in that culture, who understood connecting, understood unity, and understood the importance of building relationships to make Memphis get to the next level. Now it was like that now where we are connected, where it's just these artists signing these artists, putting on these artists, putting on these artists, and it just keep flourishing.
That is very true. And I think that whether it's on the rap side or on the production side, one of the big innovations that I've seen over the last 20 years in hip-hop is people letting go of the competition and embracing the collaboration and understanding all boats can rise together. And, you know, if the pie keeps expanding, it doesn't matter, you know.
I feel like Drake is a good example of it, because he took that idea and just created an avenue for so many artists he put on. Like I said that before, like, he was one of the people who you said, he see an artist that might be coming up back in the day, a big successful artist, be like, nah, they competition. He the type of person, he gonna embrace them, do a song with them.
That's
know,
how you get Look Alive. And
right, you know, and just keep it going. Now that person, that producer from Memphis who had something going on and he made it bigger, now he's able to put on these other Memphis artists and they make, you know, a living for themselves. Now these artists are putting on people and it just keep going on. It's a legacy.
No, and for Drake, he got Jimmy Cooks and he got Nonstop and, you know, all these records, you know, because of that relationship that he was able to create with you. And all of that came out of just, hey, I like that song. I'm gonna help that kid. Right. When you make a record, do you feel like you can predict whether or not it's going to be a hit?
Never, because there have been times where I've made beats that I thought was going to be a hit and nobody rapped on them. To this day, I got 5 to 10 beats right now that I know would be one of the greatest songs that can ever exist, like, within the hip-hop industry, and it just ain't nobody rapped on them. So you can never predict, and then it also be times where you can be sitting on a beat for so long, you think nothing of it, and you be in a studio with an artist and play him that beat, he be like, load that up right now, I'm finna make this, and it become a hit. So it's never predictable.
We talked to The Dream a few weeks ago, and he was...
The Dream was one of my mama's favorite artists.
Really?
Yeah, she loved The Dream. That's why every time I listen to it, it just make me think of her. Like, The Dream was one of her favorite artists for sure. She had all his CDs.
That's dope. Shit. Yeah, I mean, he's one of the illest. Yeah. He was talking about, I think it was Thick from the Beyonce record. Mm-hmm. He was like basically saying that he had given it to her 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then one day he just gets a call like, yo, can you bring up that session? He's like, what are you talking about? She's like, remember the one? Yeah. And he was like, yeah, sure. And then, you know, it becomes a smash then 10 years later.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But when you, as a producer, once you put those records out into the world, and you're obviously working with the most elite talent, if a Drake or a Beyonce or someone like of that level likes a beat and kind of just puts it to the side, do you just have to be at peace with knowing that is either going to turn into something magical at some point, or I might never hear about this again.
Yeah, I think one thing about me that made me like comfortable with accepting that I possibly got a song placed or not is the fact that I feel like I solidified myself enough to, if I was never to get a hit again today, from today on out, I did enough. I did enough. I feel like I truly proved myself in the hip-hop industry and somewhat in the pop also. And the culture, I've made my imprint. So when it comes to like me having potential records and songs, I don't think too hard on it. It just is what it is. I'd be cool if it come out, but if it don't, it's all right.
Which is more fun for you at this point, making a street record with a Key Glock or Moneybagg Yo, or one of these high-stakes sessions with an A-list, with a Beyonce or a Drake or someone like that?
It's the same. It's always a thrill because one thing you can take from what I guess I created with making these street records is it has the potential to be a hit. You don't expect it to be a hit like a street record. Like, to be, you can expect it to be a club banger and you go, it get played in all the clubs in the South. And as far as like those big artists like Beyonce and Drake, you just be so like, just in a moment of, I can't believe I made it to this point, that is everything that happens is just, in those moments, it's just like, you know what I'm saying? You can't take that for granted. One important thing that Nav told me, he was like, he want to get to the point where he able to do shows and tour like cities in like the southern states and the cities. And that kind of stuck with me because like when you think of like big songs in the South, you don't really think of how big they are and how much of an influence the southern artists have. But it's like when it comes to big songs, like especially like big artists, a lot of them wouldn't have that same like attention or support when it comes to the southern states. But it's like now Memphis have this scene and even Arkansas having a big music scene now, and Alabama artists and Georgia artists, like those artists nowadays is just like having such of a big impact that it's making people realize how important the South was, and me just being one of the front runner producers for it, bringing that sound, not just Memphis, but the southern sound, to mainstream music.
Coming from New York, I can remember when New York had it, and then I remember when LA had it, and it feels like for 20 years, it's just been moving around the South from, you know.
Well, New York got the big drill movement now, and I love that because drill has basically, in my eyes, become a sub-genre. You know, I think a lot of people crucified me for making my sound and sticking with it. But then it's like drill now has become such of a big impactful thing. It makes me more comfortable with what I was doing. I was doing something right.
Obviously, trends come and go in music. And at certain points, you have the serendipity that everything is like lightning. 2018, the thing you're doing just becomes the thing. Yeah. How do you predict or think about gaining your own relevance while still maintaining the integrity of the Take Heath sound that, you know, and that you've been facilitating this brand?
Yeah. It's just like everybody else then did. There's two ways you can look at it. You collab with the most upcoming hyped artists, the newest artists, and that's making motion and music and creating a way for themselves and bringing your sound to their sound. Or it's also the producers. That being said, like, it's a lot of new producers that come, like, embracing them, like, all of the producers that came after me, I embraced them. I, you know what I'm saying, acknowledged them and gave them their flowers and worked with them and made songs with them. Like, that alone is, like, what keeps you relevant and also keeps your sound relevant, too, because it's going to always be new songs, new ways. And like you said, like, you know, all of the new producers will go through the same thing that I went through. You had those super hype moments, you had those low moments, those dips, but if you keep working, you have a good, successful year again like I did this year. So it's just like, you just got to keep working, networking, understanding that it's new ways to come, embrace them, and work with them.
Obviously, this year has been, again, huge for you. Yeah. What was the feeling like for you, you know, just internally in 2020, 2021? Obviously, 2021, you're dealing with personal things with your mother's passing, but I think anyone that we all work in entertainment, we're all sensitive to when we're hot and when we feel a little cool. Right. How did you manage your way through that and not let it get you down or just keep moving forward?
That's a good question. I feel like what the one thing that I really did that helped me was, like I said, keep working with the up and coming artists. So at the time it was like Pooh Shiesty, Big Scar, the new 1017 artists, and the new artists who was coming up in Memphis, and just embracing them realizing like, damn, this take heat, but then me realizing like, damn, I gotta make some shit shake. And then working with them and understanding like the impact that we had together or still have together now is just like one of the examples of me dealing with it. And another thing was me having those good relationships with the labels and the artists and the people who I was around, just like to get in those sessions with the artists to potentially make a hit. And it wasn't like the whole time I was trying to get another hit, it was like I wasn't comfortable with what I had already done. I could have did Look Alive, Sicko Mode, and Nonstop, and then that been it. But then it's so many other songs now, like my catalog so crazy now with the songs I've been doing and done in the past, even with the up-and-coming artists, that it was like I wasn't realizing that at the time it was okay if I didn't have a hit then, because I had already solidified myself. That's why these new artists even look up to me now, you know what I'm saying? Or want to work with me now, because they know how solidified I am, and I just didn't realize that. So that helped also. Like now, me having this successful year, it just made me realize like it wasn't never over for me. One time where it just stopped, everything just stopped. I just had to understand things for God to bless me more. And one of those things is understanding, like being thankful and having gratitude of where I have made it to and what I have become.
What is your process of discovery for finding new artists and keeping up with all the young kids coming out?
I think one of the things that helped me find new artists would be like if my like team talking about them, I'm seeing them like YouTube where you find a lot of the new artists, especially if you just let it play. You're going to see what's hot. You click on an artist that you like, an upcoming artist, and you just let it play. More and more upcoming artists going to keep playing. And then it's like you hearing what's going on in the streets. Just me being who I am and the artists and the people that I still have that connection intact. So that's a important asset that I have, a valuable asset that I have that a lot of other people probably don't have, just me being able to still be connected. So I'm knowing what's hot, what's not, who people fucking with, who they not fucking with, you know what I'm saying? Like, is this artist cap in their rap or what's really going on? Like, you just know you hearing this. And that point of view, like, me being able to reach out to these artists and work with them and help change their life for the better, it just make me feel good, too.
So it's part of the job, right? But then the other part is you feel like it's paying forward,
right,
too.
Like how you looking at how, like, Drake, how he can single-handedly make people millionaires now. Like, give them hits and shit. Like, yeah. It's like almost like the same thing is happening for me and the artists that I've been helping. Like, just even the producers, like, being able to change their life, like,
I wanted to talk about that part. So you now have a group of artists that sort of work. How would you describe the business?
When it comes to, like, the artists that I have or that are associated with me, it was more based off of our relationship.
Is it like a management relationship or more of like an artist collective or a producer collective.
So I think you were referring to Fast Cash Boys.
Yes.
So I started with them music. I'm one of the few artists that I started with in high school. And okay. They had a buzz then, so I worked with them. I feel like I owed them that. I was obligated to do that because they had helped me so much with my name and my buzz in Memphis growing up, like alongside with Block Boy and Key Glock and that shit too. So we did a one-off tape deal together, and we got them seen by a lot of people, millions of streams, and now they got their own deal situation. So that's an example of the people who I helped. They actually, now they're in the industry, they working on their own shit now, and being able to flourish just based off of them helping me from the get-go.
What would you say is the key to successful networking for young producers, young artists?
I just told somebody this in one of my events. I basically told them, when you networking, it's always about what you bringing, what you bringing to the table. That's what matters the most, because you can't network if you ain't got shit to bring. What the fuck you gonna bring? Just yourself, your time, and your energy? I mean, that can work as far as you being somebody, I guess, like friend or something, hopefully you can build from that. But as far as like you want to network with people, you have to bring something to the table. If you don't have nothing to bring, then you won't flourish in that situation. So you gotta have something to bring if you networking. You can't expect people to be sorry for you or feel sorry for you or wanna do something just because of sympathy and shit. That don't work.
Funny, when I was a young writer, I always used to look at when I would meet editors at magazines and stuff and think like, what can I do to make this person's life easier? Like that's my value proposition is, I can turn my copy in, it can be cleaner, it can be on time, it can make them look good to their bosses. Right. And if I can do that, it's not a transactional thing, but just the confluence of all of it is gonna end up with me being in a positive space with positive relationships with the right people.
Right, exactly. You got a point right there, because you know, when you're talking about making it easier for somebody, people don't understand it. They want to make it easier for themselves. You want to get you a hit, or you want to work with this person because you want it to benefit you. What can you do that can benefit the person you want to benefit from? It has to be mutual.
Yes.
If you want to network, it has to be mutual. But if you want to bring, if you don't want to be an opportunist, you have to understand what you bring and must have value to whatever you're trying to get. And then even with that, you might be able to bring something that other people can bring too, and you want to build with this person or work with this person, whatever, then you have to show you're loyal, you have to show you're down, you have to show trust, you have to build with that person outside of what you can bring. Because if you show this person you're a trusting person, a loyal person, you build that type of connection with them, then it won't be about, you know what I'm saying, what they can do for you or what you can do for them. That will instill, and then everything outside of that would just make it a plus.
Absolutely. When you think about where you want to be at 40 or 50, what are the big goals? What are the big achievements on your list?
Like I did say, my education. I want to go finish my education, get more degrees, and then also I want to be successful outside of music. I want to be in a position where I can look at music like, let me do this for fun. You know, right now, of course, it's fun, but it's competitive. It's for the bills. It's for the lifestyle. That's pretty much what's supporting it. But I cash out on one of these companies I'm invested in 20, 30 years, $100 million, maybe a billion or something. And I just sit back and be like, man, I'm going to make a song with this artist just because I want to today. And don't care what they do with it. I give them, fuck it, you can have it. I just want to create this. When I get to that point, that's what I would consider myself, like, accomplished when it comes to, like, myself outside of music.
key to being flexible and able to adapt lies in having a rock-solid understanding of your principles. 5 years is a long time in pop culture, and Take Heat's ability to make hits at both ends of such a wide window is a testament to his core values. Be forthright with your collaborators and seek out mutually beneficial partnerships where you're giving as much as you're getting. And of course, it helps to have an ear as attuned to giving people what they want as Taze. I especially want to thank Take Heat for his candor and his willingness to talk honestly about some of the most difficult times in his life. The challenges Tay faced caring for his mother at such a young age are both heartbreaking and awe-inspiring. His fundamental decency is an obvious testament to her legacy. Thanks for tuning in to the Idea Generation podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can be instrumental in its continued success by leaving a rating, or better yet, a review, on your podcast platform of preference. This kind of digital word of mouth is the best way to introduce others to the show and give us the platform to host conversations with these incredible creative people. And of course, don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, I'm Noah Callahan Bever. And thanks to our partners at Tres Generaciones Tequila for making today's episode possible.